Planting churches is more complex. Growing churches is more complex. So let's now dig into this topic of engaging disciples, not spectators. And think with me about the state of our churches. Who is happy with the level of engagement of the congregation in the ministries of church? Now, early stage church plant, you might be. We did what we call what we did a parachute church plant, where we just moved into a new area. We had no church affiliations and so on, just landed there. Kathy, me and the kids. And some early church plants, you can have a very high engagement if you've gone with a core group. The core group is right involved and so on. But most of our churches, there's an old stat, an old story from our American friends who are wonderful people. Where's our American brother? They're really impressive, wonderful people. The kind of talk they have is that 20% are doing 80% of the work, 30% aren't going to do any ministries and won't, but 50% they say would, they just don't know how. Now, that's an interesting little statistic. It doesn't quite play out in the Australian scene. I think most of the churches I engage with probably have a higher... It's not 20% doing 80% of the work. It's a bit higher. But nonetheless, there's still the latest NCLS, National Church Life Survey data came back saying 30% want to be used more than they are. They just don't know how to be used. And the congregations don't know how to... But leadership don't know how to engage. The point here is that our ministry engagement as congregation in church and participation is not great. Little irony, bigger churches, well-run bigger churches have a higher percentage of ministry participation than smaller churches. The little myth is that mega churches have got a low, you know, it's full of consumers who don't do much. That has not been our experience. And so just to be, now that's partly, I think if we're going to reach the UK, if we're going to reach Australia, we need to have lots of church plants and lots of big churches. We've got to have a whole, all of that, and big churches are quite compelling and powerful. But imagine the multiplication of your impact as a church if you could have more people involved in the work. And it's here that I think, again, another fundamental point needs to be made. So reflect on this question. Why is it we long to see more people serving? Why do we want a higher percentage of our people engaged in ministry service amongst us? Now, I've predisposed you in a direction with that question. But I think the most obvious answer, just given our conversation so far, would be, why do I want more people involved in the ministries? To make our churches more effective. You see, there's what predisposes down that direction. But I want to keep encouraging us to see that we want to have more people involved in our ministries to see the full measure of Christ realised in our churches. Do you see? Ephesians 4, build the church, add numbers, so build in number, and build in maturity those that are in the church, by having them join in the work. Do you see? Because by their work, by their ministry participation, they enable the further adding of people and the deepening of people. And by joining in, they are building themselves. Because by participating in ministries, they reach themselves a deeper sense of what it is to be Christ-like. So Philippians chapter 2, have this attitude among yourselves that was in Christ Jesus, who, being very nature God, did not consider equality with God something to be grasped, but emptied himself and made himself nothing. And so why do I want more people participating in ministries? Because I want them to be Jesus-like, you see. Why do I want them more involved in ministry? Because I want this church to be more effective at building, more in and do. See, the two things. Critical, appreciate both things. Critical, appreciate that for a person to fail to participate in the ministries, whether informally or formally, is to fail to be truly human. For a person to fail to participate in the ministries of the church is to fail to be truly human. because it is, Acts chapter 20, more blessed to give than receive. Do you see? I was made to be like Jesus, who is, at heart, God the servant. Do you see? And Philippians 2 and John 12, it's glorious to be a servant. When is a man, a woman at their best? When is it that they're at their most glorious? It's when they're serving like Christ. That's humanity at its greatest, servant-hearted. Now, I'm doing all of this and I'm banging on this again because one of the key drivers towards spectators becoming disciples is a reason. And it's not that your congregation members might be workers in our enterprise, but it is that they may be who they are made to be. Ministers, servants, that they embrace a totally different cultural mindset. It is more blessed to give than receive. It is more blessed to be a ministering servant, captured up in the purposes of God to seek and save the lost. It is more blessed. Which is why, when more people are mobilised well, we'll see that cause the church to grow and mature and become more like Christ because we're more ministering and serving to one another. You see how it all works. And the key to this happening, in large measure, is how attractive it is to live in service of the King. Do you see? It's not just there's a job that needs doing, do it. But it is what you're made to be is this glorious, Christ-like person who is like the Macedonians. Do you remember the Macedonians, 2 Corinthians chapter 8? Who pleaded with the privilege of giving because of the grace that was so at work in all their lives. Like the Lord Jesus, who though rich became poor so that by his poverty we might become rich. It's riddled all the way through the scriptures, this sense of what it is to look like Christ is to be glorious in being a servant-hearted sacrificial minister. That's who you are, you see, who you're made to be. The key to, therefore, attracting more people into service is helping them appreciate what it is to be human and how glorious that is, that they might break free from the self-centered world around them and live different lives. And be captured in the purposes of God to bring all things under Christ as the church being the vanguard of that happening. Now the key too, therefore, is you as a leader and the extent to which you, your words and your life match what I've just taught you. We want more people serving, recruited to ministry, not spectators, because that is to be captured up in God's great purposes, to sum all things up in Christ, the vanguard of that being the church, the growth of the church, the building of the church numerically, spiritually, to be all that you're meant to be, to participate. We want all of that to be the case. We're calling people to it and teaching people to it. The great challenge is our words may say one thing, but our lives another. And the power to get a church captured to ministry is the alignment between your words and your life, so that that alignment produces a multiplier. So when you say the words, your life says the words, and the whole thing empowers the messaging. Now I'm going to bring Coles to Newcastle. You know Winston Churchill? Have you heard of Winston Churchill? I'm going to tell you a Winston Churchill story, which is probably wrong, you'll know, but it works for me, all right? So in Australia, no one knows, so I can say what I like about Winston Churchill. But apparently, he was imprisoned in the Boer War. He was failed Gallipoli thing. He was in Parliament for one party, but then out for another party, then back in for another party. He was Prime Minister, kicked out, Prime Minister back. I got the kind of basic gist right, yep. He gave a talk at I Understand, one of your great public schools. Is there a school called Eton? I don't know, something like this, right? And he gave the farewell speech, you know, the going out speech or whatever you call it here, and to the exiting students. And apparently, and again, whether it's true or not doesn't matter, it's a really good story. But apparently he got up and all the students are gathered here, Winston Churchill, and he said this. He said, let's see if I can, never give up. Never give up. Am I doing this right? Never give up. And then sat down. Now, just in terms of length, that's a great speech. Isn't it? That's all I had to listen to. But hear the words. When he says never give up, do you see what it does for you? Because his life has lived in expressing the idea to never give up. So there's this power, right? Now, you stand at the pulpit and say it's more blessed to give than receive. And you only work 45-hour weeks as a minister of the gospel. Your words mean nothing. Your words mean nothing. So there's a couple of ways that you can actually undermine by your life the message and betray your real heart. Let me give you the two. The first one is the fear of calling people to a radical service, a costly service. If you're afraid of calling people to do things that's actually sacrificial, painful and hurtful for them, you don't actually believe what you say. You see, the Lord Jesus demonstrates what it is to live the truly human, glorious life. He died to save. Do you believe that? Well, then you'll call people to the burden of costly service as a gift to them, as a blessing. I worked with a person, once paid ministry staff member, who was struggling to build a ministry team, just struggling to recruit people to the ministry team, and tried to dig into what was happening, why were you finding it hard to recruit and so on, because recruitment's part of our life. And as we talked, they shared that they didn't like asking people to step into this work because it was so costly. And they were happy with the broad appeal, but not the close personal recruitment conversation. We tried to dig into why, and I asked this, do you struggle to ask people to do everything? Is there ever an occasion where you're happy to ask people to do things? And they thought about it and said, well, yeah, there are some things I don't mind asking people to do. What are those things? The ones that I think they'll find beneficial. Do you see what's just happened? They've just admitted they don't think inviting someone to do hard ministry is more blessed. Now, right there was a diagnosis of an issue that was a heart issue, you see. Now, let me try and diagnose this a little bit further with the language of thank you. Forgive me if you've heard me do this before. But think about the word thank you. When I invite someone to do a hard, burdensome ministry as the leader of a church, and I go and say thank you for doing that work, what does the word thank you communicate? When I thank someone, what am I doing? I'm expressing appreciation, but I'm doing something a little bit more. And you know you're doing something more when we've got a mood around at the moment where a wife says you ought not thank the husband or the child for cleaning the kitchen. Now, why might a wife say, I'm not thanking the 16-year-old when they come and clean the kitchen? Why might they be unhappy about thanking the child for that task? That's just what you do in this family? Why else might they be unhappy to thank the 16-year-old or the husband? No, you don't think that. I mean, okay, well, whatever. But what thank you communicates is that you've helped me do my job. That's what thank yous are. I thank you for doing something. What I'm saying is you've helped me out, and I'm giving appreciation for you having helped me. Right? We've now understood the word thank you. If someone steps up to lead Sunday school in the church I'm the pastor, and I say, look, thanks so much for doing that, what have I just said to them? You've helped me out. Who should do the thank you in that relationship? Who should be thanking whom? Who? Who should be thanking which person? They should be thanking you because you've given them an opportunity to serve the cause of Christ for their blessing and privilege. They ought to be coming to you and say, thank you so much for inviting me to do such a difficult ministry because it's been a great blessing for you. But when you thank them, you've just twisted the whole thing. And you've just displayed that you actually don't believe what you're teaching. Do you see how these things work? Wrestling with this stuff is important. I'll tell you the second way we undermine is our hours of work. It is concerning to me, it's emerging more and more that paid pastoral staff are working less and less. There's a great concern for burnout, health and flourishing, and so many are limiting themselves to 45-hour weeks. But what does this say about our place and our role in ministry and the way we think about ministry, that we think about it as a 45-hour week? What does it say? It says it's a job we do, not the great purpose of our lives. It's a job I do, it's not my life. A parent, a mother or father who says, I'm just doing 45-hour weeks, kids, outside my time, I've got to sit, is a mum or dad who thinks about parenting in a way that I just think is foreign and weird and destructive. The shape of Paul's ministry, you look at the language Paul uses, he laboured harder than any of them. His life was like a mother or father, he didn't think hours. It was his whole life. You cannot build a ministry. Well, it's very hard to get people to step up into sacrificial ministries in your church if everyone knows you're not working hard. Just, if they see you making sure you have a balanced life, a flourishing, forget ever getting people much in ministry. Now, again, I'm throwing all this out there. We can have a conversation soon. But notice what I'm doing here. What I'm doing here is working on us. We're the key. Our heart for ministry and passion for it and clarity around it will be the key to getting passion for ministry in the congregation. You see. Before ministry, recruitment is a technique. It's a heart that you as a leader must have. What you bring is no surprise, 1 Timothy 3, Titus chapter 1. Who you are is the key to what happens, which is why we choose, so Orlando, it's why you choose people who have gospel heart before technique. Now, there's much more to be said, of course, in this, but come back with me again to the question of, is there more that, how? Okay, now, there's much more to be concerned. Let me give you an insight into a ministry tool that we use quite a bit. I think I use it every day, conceptually, if not explicitly. It's known as the now, where, how. Have you heard of the now, where, how? Okay. So, think with me about three circles. You've got now, where, how. What we've just been doing is talking a lot about the where you want to take a ministry to. What's the outcome you're after? The where, the vision. What's the thing you're trying to achieve, the difference you want to make? So what do you want your church to look like if it's a fired up ministry-minded church? The where. But you also need to pay attention to where things are now. What is the state of your church in terms of the numbers of people engaged in ministry, the health and so on and so forth? Now, there's the now, there's the where, they'll be different. So the next question comes is, how do I move from now to where? Now, a little ministry tip, which is typically the way, the rut that we can fall into is thinking first now, then how. And so what tends to happen is leaders go very quickly to the hows and then go to the silver bullet and spend a lot of time as a team, as a leadership, focusing on one thing. What's the big thing that's going to make the world of the difference? The better way to do it is always go from, I think where, start with where, go back to now, then how. If you start with where, you're better placed to understand the now, to identify what really matters about the now, because you know what matters about the where. Whereas if you start with the now, you can start with all kinds, you end up talking about all kinds of things that really are irrelevant. Start with the vision, where, the outcome. Where are we now? Let's now talk how, because the how will lead us to get there. Is this a kind of sense of it? Now, I live in that world all the time. As the leader, I'm always in my mind or explicitly asking questions, where are we trying to get with this? What's the outcome we're after with this? Where is it things now? How do we get there? And what I'm looking for in the how is 6, 12 hows. I want to know a bunch of hows that are going to produce the change from the now to the where. I don't just want to hear one big one. I want to hear a whole bunch of small ones, some more expensive, costly ones, some bigger ones. So we do lots of brainstorming as a team around all the possible hows, and then we analyse together which are the ones we're going to invest in. Now, how? So how do we go from how do we get to the ministry vision from a place of not much? What are the hows? The first how I've been talking to you a great deal about is you. You're one of the hows. Who you are, the heart that you have, the passion, the clarity of heart. And you need to keep praying, working on your heart, sitting under the word and so on. But here we go, a little bit further. Dig a bit more into the where. What kind of where do we want? We want an every member ministry, Ephesians chapter 4. We want every part doing its work. But what kind of ministries do we want them doing? There's a way we've often not thought about. What kind of ministry structure are we wanting to establish in our church? What shape do we want for the ministries? Now, I think that's a question we've not often asked. And it's one of the ruts we're in. The reason we don't ask it is because we've inherited a ministry structure that's already in place that we've received from generations of evangelical ministry. And if I could summarise, the ministry structure we've inherited is this: a Sunday service, band, sound, setup, preaching. A kids' ministry, everyone has one of those. Teachers, I need a superintendent, because I can't be there, so I need to rate up a leader who can do it while I'm not there. Driven to that. And the third piece is, if you're from our world of evangelicalism, small group structure. Bible study group, growth group, whatever you call it. There's the ministry structure we've inherited. Very few of us question it. And we just assume my aim in ministry is to recruit to that structure. And once I've recruited to that structure, job done. Now, there's a power to that, actually. And the power is, unaware, what we have done is do a principle. So I've given you, to grow churches, you have clarity, faithful to inputs, take responsibility, build responsibility. The fourth principle is break down the larger outcome of make disciples into component pieces. Now, break it down is our fourth principle. So what's the big outcome? Making loving disciples, making disciples in ever-increasing, mature disciples in ever-increasing number. That is a massive task. To achieve it, you need to break it down into component parts so you can work on the bits that will build to the outcome. Does that make sense? And the way we've done it classically is a simple system approach where we identify three key systems and just run them. Sunday service, kids' ministry, and small group work. Now, here's the pragmatic reality. If you work those three structures and make them work well, you'll do reasonably well. Church planting, one of the things we say to church planters is, just make sure you've got those three things in place and firing. You can't do everything. Get those three things in place. You can add a fourth, youth ministry. Get a good youth ministry in place. Think of that way of breaking it down, the major outcome, breaking it down into key systems approach. And if experience shows, if you've got at least these three structures working well in the environment of our church culture, you'll be a place that will likely grow. The problem with it, though, is that it underperforms. It's pat. That is, you know, it's, we've just inherited it. We haven't thought about it. We just do it because everyone does it, you see. And it's not always clear why we're doing each piece, what part they play. So think with me about growth groups. Why do we run growth groups? What's the outcome we're trying to achieve there? What part does it play? We haven't always thought about it. Or if we have, I think we've come to an answer that's not the best answer, but that's another issue. What is also concerning about the key systems approach to breaking it down is that it fails to mobilise the whole church. Now, let me explain what I mean. If we've got 50% or 30% of people who want to do more ministries but don't know how, we've also got a senior leader who doesn't have much more for them to do than either lead the singing, play in the band, be a kids teacher or a growth group leader, or hand out books at the door. That's pretty much all we recruit to. And so if once I've put out those possibilities, there's not much left to do. Now, it's good, but it underperforms, because what I want to show you is there's much, much more to do if you just have the eyes to see, and you can build a ministry structure that actually will be a powerfully compelling structure. See, there's two other ways you can break it down. Let me take you through each of these reasonably quickly. The next way to break it down is what we call the pathway system. The pathway. See, make disciples in ever-increasing number. Put aside the structures we've been running and just come at it from first principles. If you break down just conceptually from make disciples, there are two dimensions to make disciples: get and grow. Get people converted, grow them. But under get, you can break that down into a series of component outcomes that are needed to be achieved. To get people converted, you've got to contact them, gospel, convert them, establish them in faith. Under getting someone saved, you've got a series of other component outcomes that need to be achieved. Do you see what I'm saying here? Under maturity, the same. Under growing people in the faith, you need to establish people in the church. You need to get them matured in word and prayer, serving and on mission. So hidden behind the large outcome are two sub-outcomes that make up. And hidden behind each of those sub is other sub-outcomes. But what I've done, notice what I've done, it's just a more thoughtful, intentional analysis of the outcomes needed to be achieved to achieve the big outcome. And notice it's all outcome language. It's not input language, it's outcome language. These are the things that need to be achieved. Now, here's the thing. Each of these outcomes or sub-outcomes don't just happen. Sometimes they do, but often not. And if we're more intentional and make sure each outcome actually happens, we'll see more people saved and established in the church and the church grow. You just will. This trades on that discussion we had earlier about compatibilism, the theology of God's sovereignty in our part. If we more intentionally make each part of the pathway work well, we'll see more people converted, established in faith, established in church, back on, and so on and so forth. Take follow-up, the established in the faith, that piece there. I worked with John Chapman for some time. I don't know if you guys know John Chapman, but I had the privilege of working with him on staff. And he would say, back 50 years ago, follow-up was person can profess faith, here's a tract and the address of a local church. See you later. That was follow-up. But 27 years ago, when we started church, I'd had some previous ministry experience and so on, and was conscious that if we did that, then the parable of the sower, you know, the quarter response that kept going, you know, would be a tenth. you know, we just see less people come through. So we committed to a much more intentional, richer follow-up process to ensure that every person who professed faith was walked with through what it meant to be a follower of Christ. 10 months we committed to doing that. What we did then was we took responsibility for the outcome and made sure we built a ministry that paid attention to achieving that outcome, you see. And in fact, we've set a vision back all those years ago, which we still carry, and it's this, that every single person who walks through our door, I want to have them personally walked with through the journey of their faith into our church. You imagine if you could pull that off. Every single person has someone personally walk with them through. That's been our vision from the beginning. Now, think about serve. So this is serving. This is people joining in the ministries, you see. That doesn't just happen. It's called the maturity myth. The maturity myth. The maturity myth goes like this. If I just preach and pray, like Spurgeon did, people will all step up and organically and spontaneously, like the Macedonians, give themselves to ministries and the church will flourish and grow. Now, the problem is that does sometimes happen, which means we can look at the occasions where it happens and say, see, it does happen, and wouldn't it be beautiful that it always did, but it doesn't always outside of revival. I just, on the plane over, watched the Jesus Revolution. Have anyone seen that out here, the Jesus? Forget the illustration. no point, I thought you'd all would have seen it. But it doesn't just spontaneously happen. We need to give attention to getting people to step up into ministry. Here's the deal. What I'm suggesting is we've identified the global where we want every member ministry. What we're now doing is rethinking the where in terms of the ministry structure we're recruiting to. What we now have is a model of ministry structure that's richer than the simple system approach. What we now have is 8 things that need to be done and done well. So what we now have is a plan. I've got to recruit ways in which we can get contact established, gospels established well. I've got to get every step of that pathway resourced. Resources always take up 3 things. If you want to resource a work, you've got to find people, time, and money. I've got to have the number of people who can give it time, and I need to financially undergird it with facilities or rents or money or whatever. People, time, and money. And here's the point. When you consider the larger need of the gospel in our countries, the totality of what we're trying to achieve across all those things means we need an army of people resourcing this. But here's the deal. What a blessing. What a blessing to actually invite more people to get the whole thing working. Now, here is your job as a senior pastor. It's to live with the dream about what could be in your church that's bigger, deeper, better, richer than just a simple systems approach. It's the dream of filling that so that every part is firing, to have the whole body of Christ incorporated with all their different gifts. In the past, with simple systems, all we've been is one head, a mouth, and one hand. So it's been this very dysfunctional body. But once you pay attention... Now, that emerges from a more intentional break-it-down engagement. But let me give you the third way to break it down, and then I'll pause for questions. Let me give you the third way of breaking it down. It's the pentagon. Now, this is a powerful piece because what it does is it says a couple of different things. If you go back to the pathway, could you take us back there? What I want you to notice with the pathway analysis, it's missing some pieces and it's a linear analysis. It's the kind of analysis an engineer forms, right? It's a linear thing. What's missing there? Can you see what outcomes we're after in the mature Christian and the mature church? What's missing there? I think there are two bits missing, two outcomes. Can you see what they are? Let's test you. Can you see what's missing? Yeah. So one piece we think is missing is the thing we call magnification. But we've on our Pentagon, we've called it love God. And the reason it's missing in a pathway now, because it doesn't fit in a progressive pathway. So if you just look at church as a pathway, it doesn't quite figure. Or if it figures, it'll figure as the umbrella over it all. But if it figures as the umbrella over all, it won't get resourced. So it'll be underdeveloped in your church. And so we think love God, magnification, the sense of delighting, the Christian growing to love their Lord, you see, is missing. There's another piece that's missing, which, yeah. Nice. What's missing too is community and life together. See, it's a complex theological thing that we need to appreciate. As I said this earlier, church is about edification and developing and growing to build the church. But it also is an end in itself. That church gathers and assembles under God to enjoy Jew, Gentile alike together is the outcome. Love, you see. It's that brothers dwell in peace together now. That's the outcome as well, right? And you don't see that on the pathway. Because where do you put that? How do you express that? So there's a couple of bits missing. But also what's missing is the way each part of the pathway interacts with the other parts. And you can't show it on a pathway. So if you wouldn't mind, put up the pentagon, Andy, if you wouldn't mind. So what we've tried to show in the pentagon is the two bits that are missing, and tried to show that what we're about is not creating a series of steps in a pathway, but what we're trying to create is a community that is growing in each dimension as a whole. We call this the ecosystem. So what we want is a church... See, pathway. If I run a church where I get a great mission team going, where they go and they do evangelism and they run a course and they do the follow-up, what happens to the rest of the church is job done. The team is doing mission. Our church does mission. The team doesn't. You see. But Pentagon says what we want to do is create all of church on mission, and we need a team to facilitate that happening. Not just facilitating one step on a pathway, but actually to facilitate this whole church being a mission church. But we also need someone to facilitate this church being a community church, a caring church, a love one another church, rather than it being a connection step on a pathway run by a team. We want a team or someone to facilitate the whole church being a welcoming environment where everyone's welcoming. With a team that has particular attention to that role, but the whole thing is there. Do you see? So the pentagon helps you see that that's what it's about. What happens is, once you've got that, if you get a church where all of those things are actually happening through the whole body, what happens is a multiplier occurs within the body, which then fires out greater mission energy and a greater pulling in of people. Church becomes attractive. People love church. They want their friends to come to church. People hear about church and want to be there. And you get a mission momentum that occurs not just by running a course, but by having the whole ecosystem with this loving engagement together. But here's my point. That whole ecosystem doesn't just happen if you preach and pray. You've got to pay attention intentionally and resource intentionally each piece of the ecosystem to get it all to fire and work. Now, I was just talking, I was talking with Rick a bit earlier. He visited our church a couple of weeks ago, but I was just sharing with him. We had a lady 4 weeks ago. I was talking with, you know, at the end of each service, I just make myself available to talk to whoever. And so I end up with lots of pastoral conversations. This is the senior minister of a very large church, right? I do pastoral stuff, right? And I'm not the CEO in an office somewhere. So I spend a lot of time talking with people and so on. So at the end of church, a long time later, there's a lady standing at the back of church. She'd been waiting a long time. And I walked up and she caught my eye and she said, I wanted to say hello, I wanted to catch up. And I said, okay. And she introduced herself. And she said, look, Pastor, I wanted to let you know that I've been here the last 3 weeks. I'm visiting. I come from a church in Sydney, and I come from a very small church in Sydney, and I intentionally chose a small church in Sydney because the church I was in combined, it got bigger, and I find myself really struggling with big, impersonal church, and I wanted to go to a small family church where I was known and loved. And she said, here's the thing, though. I've been here 3 weeks, and she said, I've never experienced a welcoming church like I've experienced in a church of our size. A couple of points there. If you intentionally pay attention to the whole ecosystem, you don't just end up with a welcome structure, you end up with a community of believers who actually love each other. And that can happen in a very large church. Mega church myth suggests that it doesn't. She proves the lie to that. She said there's just a mood here that's... Now, it's not perfect. I can say it's perfect because it's a long way away and only Rick's visited, so there we are. The point being, friends, that if you want to recruit, the where you're recruiting to is every member ministry, and the where you're recruiting to is a rich, dynamic, fully orbed system of church life that touches every dimension, which means what you're looking for as you recruit is not just the person who can lead a Bible study group now, but the person whose gifts are in love and hospitality. The person whose gifts are in recruitment, and we call them serve chats. Someone who actually just loves sitting with someone to talk about their gifts and their opportunities and possibilities, a kind of an HR thing, if you like. Someone whose gifts are in music, of course, and loving God. And what you're doing is looking for many more gifts and participation in the whole breadth of church, which means you can develop an Ephesians 4 work where it is every part doing its work, bringing the different gifts to bear, 1 Corinthians chapter 12. And the power that that brings is rich and wonderful. And it also solves the issue of wives and... Actually, I'm going to put it on Kathy. Oh, she doesn't want to put it on you. As you talk with wives about their ministry involvement in church, how does this help you think about that? Do you want to come down? This is Kathy, my wife, who has partnered. Yeah, give her a clap if she comes down. That's beautiful. She gets embarrassed by this. But Kathy's work is she now works with Reach Australia, managing all the... coaching the coaches of wives. So we do now a lot of work with, as we bring senior ministers into the whole Reach world and church planting and development, we make sure that they get a coach and their wife gets a coach. But to do that on scale, you need to raise up a whole crowd of coaches and then coach the coaches. And that's what Kathy does. So one of the things is you coach the coaches who are wives. What are you finding about this issue of their involvement in church? And how powerful it is to see a bigger, richer picture of it all. Does that make sense?
So there's a couple of things. I think pastors' wives can get quite lost in the mix. They feel like their husband knows their role clearly. People in church might be invited into ministries, but what's the pastor's wife? And I think there's a desire to not pressure her and so not have an expectation that she should do roles. But the flip side is then there's no expectation, and so she can feel lost. So one of the things I'm trying to do in Australia is help pastors' wives get the sense that, firstly, as a child of God, they're called, they've got a gift, they need to be involved in a ministry in some church. That's just for any Christian, so certainly she should be thinking of herself in that way. So just encourage them to not just abdicate from church life. but realise that's a central part of God's purposes, as we saw in Ephesians. But even more particularly for her husband, he's called to it. It's his life. You see in 1 Timothy 3, the call to be hospitable and all these kinds of things. How can he do that on his own? Like, if it's a life, it's going to impact you too. And can you be part of this fully, willingly, knowing this is God's big purpose? Can this be your big purpose? So again, not abdicate from church life. Doesn't mean you don't necessarily work if you need to work, but do you need to work, like in the paid sort of a secular role? So just trying to get wives to think through this. So that's for wives. And then women in general.
So as you talk with wives, you're finding they don't know what they could do in church.
Yeah, so a big thing I think about this too is it just broadens the range of gifts needed. And so again, if I'm not the leader and I'm not necessarily a teacher type person, is there anything left for me and I don't want to do creche? Yes, this gives you a much wider range of ministries that you can be involved in. So I think it's easier to find your place. So that's for a pastor's wife, but I think for any person as well. Yeah. Does that help?
Yeah, that's helpful. Yeah, thank you. Yeah. So what we're trying to do, so the where, this is, so as you do recruitment, the greater clarity you have around what you're trying to recruit to means your ability to recruit just escalates, you see. Now, if you wouldn't mind putting up the pathway again, I'm going to take us to an analysis where you're going to do some work. But do you want to just do any questions on this first? One of the ways it's forgive the scale, and I'll talk about church at the moment. One of the ways it's worked out for us in the last couple of years is that we have teams now that do recruitment. So and translate this down to a church of 100, but we have teams that do it, and what they work on together and take is a document, a big A2 page or something, with church in the centre circle and all the ministry circles that sit around it in all of these areas where there's needs. So the kids will be a ministry that's got circles around it, but so is too is the community and the welcome and the connection will have circles around it. We need to recruit people to those spots, and we need to recruit people to these spots. And these people have this document that shows them the 50 areas we need to recruit to. So they go and talk to a new person. So every new person in our church, we put them through a welcome membership class, as Orlando was doing. And what flows out of that is once they're established in a growth group, we require them to be in church for at least 3 months and committed to church 3 months before we start this process, because we want them to belong before they get a job, do you see? We don't want them being in us because they've got a job. We want them to love what we're about and so on. So 3 months. But at 3 months, someone will go and catch up with them and say, want to catch up about your life in church and how we can help you be part of what's happening here. So it's an intentional conversation. And what we're looking for in that intentional conversation is, tell us your story. Have you been in a church before? Have you just been converted? What's your story? What are the things you're passionate about? Let me take you through the needs of church, and we seek then to marry those two together. But what we're doing in all of that is a conversation, a pastoral conversation, where there's a much richer tapestry within which they could fit and partner our work. They don't have to be in the mould of, I lead a Bible study group. You see, it's a much richer tapestry. Now, in the early years, so let me now take it back to 100, 150, I did most of that. You see, so every new person, they came through our house and they did a membership course in our house once a month for 13 years in our house. Another 15 people came to church, you see. And then and then there'd be a deliberate follow-up of how you're going, pastoral conversation. Does that make sense? Yeah, yeah. Because what you've got to do is create a push-pull. You've got to create a pull towards ministry where you set the scene as a preacher and leader in church life of why wouldn't you devote yourself to the cause of Christ? You've got to create the climate, the pull towards, I want to give my life. I want to serve, you see. You create a pull, but then you've got to get alongside them and give them a push, which is, have you thought about actually doing something now? Let's have the conversation about recruiting you to a ministry. And unless you do both, you won't get the power of an army of people engaged here. Any other questions before I take you to the next? It's all clear? Good? Yeah. Right, what I want you to do is a thing we call a gap analysis. A gap analysis. So see the eight box level there. Does it make sense, the levels? You break it down to a very gross level, you just get grow. Break it down. Okay. What I want you to do is, and do this with the team if you've got the team there. Do it on your own and then join the team. What I want you to do is a gap analysis. So you've got contact, you've got gospel. What I want you to do, 0 to 5, put a number there on how well it's going. 0 bad, 5 good. So how we're going at contacting people is a 1. How we're going at establishing is a 2. 5's going well, 0's bad. Now, if you're here with other members of your staff, what's an interesting exercise, I do this all over the place, it's just really quite interesting. Do it on your own, just do numbers. You don't have to analyse it down to the nth degree. You'll have a quick instinct. No, it's got to be integers, not fractions. You can't do 2.5, okay? So you've got to choose either 2 or 3. Okay. Do that. Then sit with your other team member and see what their numbers were. It's a very interesting process doing that one. You make sense? Now, you do the gap analysis. I'll tell you what to do with it in a moment. Go. You've got 2 minutes. 3 minutes. Now, it's called a gap analysis because what you're looking at, you want everything to be 5s. Right? So what you're looking at quickly is to see what's the gap. So 5, where? Now, the number you give it. You see? This is a very simple thing. You can do it on the Pentagon as well. We do it. Now, as a church at EV, we did this for years. We have a whole cycle of meetings and review and so on and so forth. But we would regularly do a gap analysis on where things were at. Now, once you've done a gap analysis, your job is to lift the whole ministry, is to develop every part of your work. But in a church of 100, you haven't got the resource to make everything 5. So you've got to make choice. In a church of 2,000, you haven't got the resources to make everything 5, which feels weird, but it's, yeah. And so you've got to make choices as a leader where you're going to resource to lift, which then steps into strategic leadership. The whole process of working out, if I resource area here, on the pathway or on the ecosystem, what impact will that have on the whole, and which piece do I invest in to get the thing one step further towards being 5s everywhere? Now, that's not a formula I can give you the answer for. It's a strategic analysis given your context, gifts, opportunities, needs. And I love that part. I find it really interesting to try and get into the world of, if I pulled that lever, move people, resource, finance, time into that area and get it working better, will it position me to get the rest to work better? I find that very interesting and fascinating. But that's your job. That's your job, you see. And how well you do that will make a difference on whether or not the ministries start to get momentum and get their own energy and their own flywheel so you can walk away. There we are. All right?